this guy that I've got today on the show, folks, he has quite a story to tell about a gang, a horde, a cadre of social justice warrior comic creators who clearly have nothing better to do, like tell a good story within 1 to 2 issues, or at least be serviceable to the legacy of the character they are writing, or just to mind their own business and respect the political differences of others if they can't be loyal to the character's history that they are writing. Now, this is John Delarose, an author of For Steam and Country, which is, I guess, a steampunk fiction novel, right?
Correct.
And he also has a book coming out next week about baseball in space, what the future of baseball might be among, you know, when we begin traveling to other far imagined vistas of the stars, and that is Gravity of the Game. And we'll also talk about the recent sports controversy in a little bit, John. First of all, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking time out. I understand that you are a hot commodity right now with all sorts of podcasters and online digests and magazines and whatnot, because you have quite the story to tell. Now, you write for The Federalist, and you also recently on your personal site posted a blog about how a gaggle of Marvel comic writers proceeded to gang up on this guy who runs a very low-key, low-budget comics channel called Diversity in Comics, where he's outspoken about the just outright enforcement of diversity discredit, to the detriment of the actual stories that they're supposed to be telling. And they actually gang up on this guy, that they block him, and they also conspire to potentially get him arrested, or if failing that, to, like, I don't know, cause violence, hurt him, right?
Yeah, so I started getting involved with Marvel Comics earlier this year. I went through and I was doing some research. I found out at my local comic shop, the comic shop owner said that Marvel Comics used to be 70-80% of his sales from month to month. And he said in the last year or two, it's gone, dropped in about half. And now it's like 30-40% of his sales. And I said, wow, what happened with Marvel? And he said, well, they've kind of replaced every Marvel character. Like Iron Man's now a woman, and Thor is now a woman, and the Hulk is now a young Asian boy. And so they've replaced all of their characters with just minority knockoffs of those characters. And so nobody wants to read it because it's just garbage social justice in a book, and it's not very fun. And the whole point of comic books is to have fun. So I wrote about that, took a bunch of flack about it, and eventually I've just been kind of covering comics ever since. Once I got to that point, I discovered Diversity in Comics, gosh, about 2 months ago, when a lot of my friends started retweeting some of his pretty funny posts on the internet, and I really started following him when there was a controversy that was just called Make My Milkshake. And what happened was these editors and assistant editors and all these women at Marvel Comics went out and took pictures of themselves, women only, at some milkshake shop, and, you know, said, you know, this is diversity, derp, derp, derp. And they got a couple comments saying, you know, these are diversity hires in action, and this is the social justice Marvel like poster. And, you know, there was one mean comment that was like, I'd bang that girl or something like that. And, you know, I think everybody was like, okay, well, that's not nice. And none of us would do that and or say things like that. So, but it was just one comment. And I get worse comments daily by several people. So, and I'm a nobody. This is a gal who works at Marvel Comics. So if you're a public face like that, just on being on the internet gets you far worse comments typically. Than this, but this woman, decided to go off and say she was harassed, and the entire media went off and said she was harassed and how terrible these people who are trying to fight the social justice are. And a pretty standard thing for the media to do. And it was fake. And Diversity in Comics started mocking. So what happened was, after that, these Marvel writers and editors branded him a harasser. This is their go-to playbook. They call you a harasser, they call you a bigot, they call you a white supremacist. This is just what they do. And when they did this, they started getting people to gang up on him. I've seen the type of abuse and harassment he's taken, so much beyond what this woman said she was taking. It's really unbelievable. And last week I broke the story, which kind of went to the mainstream media. An anonymous source came to me and gave me a screenshot of a private Facebook group that a lot of comic professional writers are in, extreme left-wing group, social justice oriented. And all these people were trying to get Diversity in Comics, who's attending a Comic-Con in the near future. They were making some bizarre fantasy where they would goad him into throwing a punch or goad him into violence somehow in an effort to either get him kicked out of the con or kicked out of cons for good, or to get arrested even. So it was a conspiracy towards violence and to ruin this guy's life, basically, all because he writes reviews and told the truth about this one controversy in Marvel Comics.
Now, I understand that Marvel is, in recent years, or maybe I think going back as far as 15 years, they've had a history of being dismissive of conservative people in the medium, such as Chuck Dixon, who created the character Bane for DC, right? They won't return his phone calls, will they?
No, not him, nor a friend of mine named Brett R. Smith, who actually, he's one of the best colorists in the industry. He actually worked with Chuck on the graphic novel for Clinton Cash last year during the campaign, and both of them have blackballed from the industry. Marvel won't return their calls. Marvel is very much committed towards this narrative and towards politics, and they have been for a long time. It goes back pretty far, actually. I think the real early instances of it were when they decided to do a gay marriage in X-Men and make Marvel into a half black, half Hispanic Spider-Man or something like that. And they even ran a 2008 historic Obama election special Spider-Man with its own, you know, special Obama cover, and Obama was in the issue and, you know, hanging out with Spider-Man, being a good guy, super propaganda. I actually, a fun side story, I tagged Marvel editor Axel Alonso last week and I said, hey, when are you going to be doing a historic Trump issue like you did for this Obama one? And I got a lot of retweets and from that, obviously. And I tagged Dan Slott, who writes Spider-Man. I said, can you help me with this? And he blocked me immediately.
You know what's funny is that I've never even spoken to the man and I'm blocked by him.
I think there's a lot of people who are in that boat. From what I hear, there is a sort of standing order in Marvel Comics to have their writers and editors have an auto block list, and anybody who follows Diversity in Comics gets on that auto block list at this point.
Well, my question is, what is how low do sales have to tank before the creative officer Joe Quesada or Disney, the parent company who now owns Marvel, steps in and says, you know, hey, you know, knock it off. What's going on here? Why do we have these quarterly losses? Now they'll try to spin it every which way, but the fact is that the Marvel brass came forward as recently as May of this year and admitted that sales were low, and they did attribute it to certain social justice narratives present in their titles. They admitted it. So you can't pin it all on just print losing ground to digital sales.
They kind of admitted it. They mostly tried to blame the fans. You know, they pointed the finger at the fans, saying the fans are actually not responsive to this. And you know, they did this is also out of their playbook. They do almost every time. It's really your fault that you don't like this because you're, you know, a racist or whatnot. That was kind of the takeaway from the way they phrased it. But they do see something going on. Now, I was having this discussion earlier with a friend of mine, and he actually thinks that this is a gimmick intentionally for marketing, because what Marvel's done at this point is they've created this narrative where everybody's talking about Marvel. And if you look at last year this time, when kind of these books started hitting the shelves and not selling, nobody was talking about Marvel books. They were just not talking about Marvel books. Everybody's talking about DC's relaunch, how great it is. DC's really actually just put out some quality stories with no politics in it, by contrast. But Marvel is just not being talked about. And they've been committed to this social justice thing for a long time. You know, it's been 10 plus years. It's not been overnight as much as it reached a critical mass kind of last year. So my friend actually thinks, and I'm almost inclined to agree, that they're actually trying to make the narrative even more crazy with these stories of blocking and violence and, you know, doing this. He thinks it's a concerted effort made by their PR department to try to get them some media attention in hopes that the media attention drives sales. Now, I think it's backfiring if that's the case, but it's an interesting strategy, and it's something that's kind of bizarre. Because I kind of almost see it as maybe something that is intentional, because you don't see the rest of Disney doing this so much. Yes, you know, there's a little bit of it, but it's pretty standard for what you see in culture. It's not really like it is in Marvel.
What I would like to know is why, if they want to create these minority characters, which is fine, you know, there's a totally a place for that, I'm sure. Why do they have to piggyback off of Thor and Spider-Man and Iron Man by making them all ethnic or female? Why can't they have their own characters and put everything that they have into making those characters as good or better than those established legacy characters? Why do they have to piggyback off and then change the characters that we know as Peter Parker, as Odin, the son of Odin, and Tony Stark, and turn them into Riri, a chick with a Viking helmet on, and what, Miles Morales?
Yeah, they... I think it delves deeper than this current problem, and I think that's a systemic problem within the industry. What we have is a group of people who are nostalgic. There's not a lot of new, younger comics fans. A lot of those people have moved on to webcomics or manga or some of the indie titles, and we don't really see them going into specialty comic shops, which is the only place these comics are distributed. It's been that way for, you know, almost 4 decades now since they went that route. But what they did, they created a monopoly like this, to where this is the only distribution for comics, period. And then they pushed the stands so much with you know, they'd put out 5-10 Spider-Man titles a month. And at that point, if you're a 14-year-old kid who's into Spider-Man, you're only buying Spider-Man. You might not even be buying all of Spider-Man. You get yourself in that habit for a number of years, and pretty soon, all that's left on the shelves is Spider-Man and Batman, and that's it. Just the regular comics from Marvel and DC. So they, based on their sort of industry strategy, created this monopoly where there were generations of people who only bought these certain characters, which are just retreads and rehashes of characters created by Stan Lee and the like back in the 60s. Well, when you have generations of people buying that and generations of people just writing fan fiction based on those characters, you're going to get some creative stagnation after a while. And that's, I think we've seen that for 20, 30 years. And Marvel really has just relied on trying to make a gimmick, like this person dying this week, or now Captain America's a Nazi, or, you know, gimmicks to just get a little bit of attention for short-term sales, because there's creative stagnation all across the board and just not very talented writers, to be frank.
Well, the Captain America as a Nazi thing doesn't offend me that much, really, if it's a long-term story that pays off with him having been deep cover. Is that the case?
You know, I stopped reading it. I find that whole concept so much of a fan fiction level, you know, it's a teenager's bad dream that they'd post up on the internet. It wasn't really worthy of my reading, and the dialogue was very bad in the first couple issues. I didn't follow kind of how it concluded, to be honest.
Now, continuing the story of the fallout from your article, highlighting this conspiracy to fuck with what's his name, Zach, what, Diversity in Comics?
My boy Zach?
My boy Zach. Is that what he goes by to everybody?
Yeah, that's how he introduces his videos. It's kind of a joke.
Right? Okay.
But let's leave it at that, sure.
What happened after all these people found out they were blocked by people like Dan Slott? These people actually, you were in their crosshairs, the crossfire here. People you care about somehow became entangled in this, or was it their followers?
I do a little bit of journalism regularly on my blog, and I hit upon a topic that kind of strikes a nerve because of how true it is. Pretty regularly at this point. My first one, I've had some pretty massive trolls, and if you go to my blog ever, every single one of my posts is riddled with, like, there's the same 3-4 trolls who have just been posting over and over and over and over again, just trying to bash me constantly. I leave it up just so people can see it, for instances like this, but it's there. I mean, you can see some of them. It originally started because Bleeding Cool took one of my articles and, Bleeding Cool is a comic news website, a fake news website, I should say, but they twisted one of my articles to claim I was trying to get a job with Marvel Comics. And they said, well, you wrote that on the page. I'm like, I wrote a sarcastic plea, hire me because I'm a better writer. It was a joke. You get a joke. There was an actual substance to the article, which is that conservatives are blackballed from the industry. And you did not choose to report on that. You decided to blast some random guy on a blog instead of, Marvel Comics, who is a big corporation doing a bad thing. Like, that's irresponsible as a, quote, news organization. So I went back and forth with him a bit, but their readers trounced my blog for a long time. They'd swear at me, call me, all this other stuff, and it goes on daily. Last night, I had a science fiction author actually call me. This is from because of a different article I'll talk about in a second. He actually started posting on Facebook about me, just saying I was disloyal and didn't support my friend's work. Very bizarre. And so I messaged him, I'm like, what's your deal, dude? And he started just berating me on Facebook and on Messenger. And I said, you wouldn't say that to my face. So the guy actually FaceTime called me and started berating me on video. Like, it was this is like a professional author, like, very, kind of respected in the industry. Very bizarre. So I get that kind of thing a lot. And you were alluding to one of my trolls last week went kind of crazy attacking my family. And they actually started posting information about my children, which I kind of panicked about, because that's a step over the line. And that is what happens with these people. They will go after your lives in a very, very scary way. I don't think this one actually came from the comic side of things. I do some science fiction journalism as well, and I did an article about a month ago that showed via actual stats and numbers that there's a high preference towards women in being published in science fiction, and that men are actually discriminated against. Well, there's a lot of women who run very powerful organizations within science fiction as well, one called the Science Fiction Writers of America. And there's one, and the president of that organization started posting, calling me a harasser. It's the same story as Diversity in Comic, calling me a harasser, all this other stuff, telling everybody to unfriend me, to block me, to never talk to me again, blackball me from the industry, right? And because of my article is what it comes down to. And from that, I think a lot of people started reposting that and trying to stir up hate about me. And I think one of the fans from that is the guy who did this. I actually, through the help of some friends, tracked down the guy's name and address from his IP. So he thought he was anonymous, but was not. And I let the police have that. And he has shut up since then, thankfully.
This individual, this author who went nuts on you. It wasn't Vox Day by chance, was it?
No, Vox is a very good friend of mine. He's been extremely supportive and has given me, actually, he's sold me a lot of books just from recommending them to people. So I like Vox a lot.
Now, what happened after that episode with the person who started, you know, looking into your family and your personal life? What happened after that? Were there any more, you know,
pieces? Yeah, my hate posts on my blog have stepped up. I've got a few on Twitter who are just kind of bashing me. The level stepped up because my notoriety stepped up. I feel like it's proportionate to how many people follow me in a way. It'd be interesting for somebody to study how this works someday, because I'm pretty sure it's kind of standard for a public online presence. But it's gotten a bit nastier too. But it's nothing I can't handle. I just don't want people going after my kids, you know.
And which one of these Marvel creators threatened to sue you if you ever contacted her again? Was that Visaggio?
No, that wasn't from Marvel. That was the president of CIPWA, who after my expose on the science fiction article there. So.
Yeah, the science fiction community has more problems than we could possibly cover here in one evening. the rabid puppies, sad puppies, whatever the hell it was a few years ago, is just another example. And in other literary circles, you look at the nonsense with the Lovecraft Award, and yet all these people, these authors, still just totally bite off of Lovecraft's style. All his characters who happen to fall under public domain, whether it was through generosity or just an ignorance of copyright and trademark laws, that they still use his ideas, the essence of his fiction in their own for decades now, and they have the gall to have his bust rendered illegitimate or something, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty sick, and I find that as a standard sort of SJW thing, is they really want to erase history. And they erase history so that we don't see what went on, because then they can make this narrative about how everybody's so oppressed and terrorized and blah, 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 blah. Whether that's true or not, we can't tell, because there's no history left back there. And just because somebody kind of made some comments at some point or whatnot, or wrote something in a story, or who knows, it doesn't necessarily mean they were a bad person for the time. And, it's really about demonizing our past and our culture in an attempt to destroy and overhaul our culture. And that's what I'm trying to fight against, frankly.
Well, we'll get to the football thing in a minute, but you know, the officer, what was it at West Point or Harvard that made the communist fist and brandished a hammer and sickle t-shirt, or he basically said he was all in with communism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now
it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I was telling a buddy yesterday, if Joseph McCarthy were alive, or McCarthyism were alive today, imagine how many of these people would already have their doors kicked in. And, you know, I used to regard the concept of McCarthyism as something horrible and, you know, a violation of liberty. And in some cases, it was. But it also gives me pause in light of all the things that are taking place and transforming our culture right now. It gives me pause to wonder, was McCarthy right all along to kick people's doors in and blacklist the playwright for Death of a Salesman from Hollywood? I mean, you know?
McCarthyism's kind of overblown, and I've actually read a little bit into the subject. His personal scope was actually only hunting down communist spies in the State Department who were working for Soviet Russia at the time. And he had a number of the lists on this list, and his list was surprisingly accurate once Soviet cables were declassified in the 90s. Almost everything in our history source books on that topic, if you ever go back to the history books in that we give to our kids in high school and all that, almost every single one of them has a primary source listed as a New York Times op-ed article. Now, I mean, if you look at New York Times op-ed articles now, you really hope that history books are not written sourcing those in the future. I mean, it's so false and phony that, you know, it's an op-ed. It is somebody's opinion, and that's all it is. And so what we got in the 50s was somebody's opinion from the New York Times, which I'm sure is just as fake news as it is now, to be honest. And that's what they branded Joe McCarthy with. Now, there were other things going on with blacklisting and all that, and I am opposed to blacklisting when it comes into creative arts, because I think artists shouldn't be afraid of voicing their political opinions, whether it's communist, whether it's something I agree with. But that had nothing to do with him personally. So it has swung definitely where you are now blacklisted if you're an anti-communist. So it's very bizarre. And I think it just goes to show that, you know, whoever gets in power, it's never good to have one side in absolute power. And if we ever get back into power again, which I think we will, because the people are getting really fed up with this, we should be careful not to do the sort of blacklisting and all that that's being done to us now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the whole sports controversy, because honestly, I don't care what people do during the national anthem or whatever. I don't know why this is a national issue. I mean, you know, the Department of Defense just kind of dismissed this question from the press when it came up, you know, do you have anything to say about the NFL taking the knee or whatever? And he says, no, I defend the country. I don't have anything to say about the NFL. And with that, the press conference was over, because, you know, he had far more pressing matters to attend to, like North Korea's insanity. But I don't, even if I don't understand why it is so important, the symbolic action of placing your hand over your heart, and people should be allowed not to, it doesn't matter whether I personally understood it ever as a kid and a teenager or not. I've come around to appreciating it, because it's irrelevant whether I feel it's the appropriate way to honor, you know, veterans and our storied history as a nation. It's a way to commemorate that prestige and history. It's a way to honor it, whether it's my preferred way or not. It's a way that we can collectively do so with an understanding that this is how we honor our past. And we have a staggeringly mighty history. For all its good and all its bad, we really do have a storied history. All the presidents that have come down the pike, it's an incredible lineage of both good and bad men, mostly men who tried to do good and didn't always do so. But I see no reason why athletes can't just go through the motions, even if they don't agree with it. I mean, as pampered as they are, I mean, there it is. What do you say?
Yeah, what I look at it as is another example of trying to remove tradition. And the tradition is to show respect, and the tradition is a gesture of respect by having that tradition by itself. And so when somebody does the kneeling and says it's not really disrespecting, because kneeling is another form of respect, it's like your kid, when you got a 3-year-old or something like that, and you told him, no, you can't have that cookie. Well, he keeps edging closer to the cookie just to try to test you. And that's exactly what this is, but like with a bunch of adults. And, you know, that's just a bad look, and it resonates badly because everybody sees that. And at the end of the day, it does represent, no matter how it is, an attempt to disrespect the country. and by proxy, you know, especially, I mean, they even say it's intentionally disrespecting the police. I mean, I don't understand why the police don't just mass boycott and stop going to these games. I mean, the government brings police to these games to protect these players and et cetera, and we pay for it on taxpayer dime. I mean, it's they should just pull out of there, frankly. But it's just a bad feeling. And you go to the game and you start sitting there. I don't see anybody talking about whatever subject they want us to talk about on this. I just see people talking about how they're disrespecting the flag. When you go to the game and you watch it, you stop thinking about how fun the game is. And this is an entertainment industry. If you're not having fun, there's no reason to pay for it. And so if you're sitting there not enjoying it and not having fun because somebody's making some political signal, and at the end of the day, the political signal is we hate half the country and we don't want you here. Giving them money to tell you that is kind of an insulting proposition. So this did trickle into baseball, which really upsets me. I've been a big baseball fan for a long time, since I was a kid. And I've been an A's season ticket holder since 2012. My parents were A's season ticket holders growing up. A big tradition of going to these games forever. And unfortunately, my Oakland A's are now taking part in this as well. And I wrote the team president and ticket office and let them know I'm not going to pay to show up after work and after I work hard every day to relax and watch baseball to get political lectures. It's just I'm not interested in that. So stop that or I'm not coming back. So, and I've heard a lot of people have done the same also.
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense to alienate, you know, Joe American, who, like you said, is just trying to unwind and enjoy a game to take their mind off of the craziness of the world and their jobs. And that's what these players are doing. Just like with the strike, you know, I hear that hockey, I'm not a follower of hockey, but I understand that hockey never really got all their viewers back after the strike in the 90s. I guess baseball yep. did, but that's all they're really doing is they're alienating Joe American, who doesn't care what their inclination or political orientation is with this. And it's the same thing with Marvel. They're doubling down instead of saying, okay, well, we won't talk about politics, you know. Let's just tell a story, you know, or let's just play a game. It's incredibly selfish, and it's awfully presumptuous to think that that's a time to make your political statement. I guess in storytelling, if it's satirical enough, I could see a justification for it, but purely in the realm of sports competition, it really has no place. Now, your new book, you said it comes out in a week, Gravity of the Game, about baseball in space. Talk about that.
It makes me sad that this is happening in baseball now, because I wrote this really as a love letter to baseball. My thought was, you know, as we expand outward as a people and set up colonies on the moon and all that, well, you know, technology is often driven by entertainment. If you look at just the power of the iPhone and how that has really, that is an entertainment device at the end of the day, has driven so much just by our culture and just by the entertainment aspect. You know, how does that work in the future? And I think that in order to get different things like, you know, artificial gravity and things like that, it'll be the entertainment industry driving it to some degree. And I extrapolated that to baseball because our history and our culture is so steeped in baseball. I mean, we don't even think about how we talk about it. When we talk about going and getting a drink and having a nightcap, you know, for our last drink of the night, a nightcap is the last game of a doubleheader for baseball. That is a term that came from baseball. When we tell people they're striking out when they're failing at dating, I mean, that's obviously a baseball reference. You know, we talk about hitting home runs. We talk about, you know, all sorts of things that are just baseball references, and it really has done a lot for our culture. So I wanted to write a little bit about that, and I wanted to drop a bunch of baseball references of my favorite players and my favorite moments in history. And it's a very short book. It's a novella, not a novel, which means it's very much on the short side. So it should just be something easy in and out. It's meant to just be kind of a heartwarming story for people who love America and love baseball to enjoy without having any politics in it whatsoever.
Okay. How intense do you think things are going to get from here? I mean, do you people keep churning up the and mentioning the Civil War rhetoric. I don't know that that Americans are disciplined enough to organize on either side to the degree that would a Civil War would actually require, but I could definitely see the lines being drawn for a cultural war, what that would entail besides doxing and, you know, this stuff with messing with other people's, you know, people's personal lives and everything. I don't know what else a cultural war would entail. I think the Civil War stuff is overblown, though, don't you?
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I mean, we're all in these situations where we're sitting here pontificating the dumbest of things, where, you know, we're talking about triggering, you know, because, you know, someone said something, oh my gosh, that's racist. What's, you know, most of the time it's not even really racist. It's just somebody's so bored and sitting on the internet, you know, that they have time to make these crazy accusations. So really what we have is we have a culture where we are so rich, we're so fat, and we're so lazy, and we're so devoid of purpose in our just entertainment and consumerist driven culture. I hate to get heavy on you guys on you here.
Go ahead.
But honestly, we're in that sort of state, which is why the tensions are so high on just like a stress level. But because of those very reasons, again, you know, there's no reason to go take up arms and actually fight. I mean, it doesn't make sense. We are the wealthiest, fattest group of humans in history. And we frankly have it too easy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that I would pass the exam, to be honest, and I don't know if I would be cut out for it. But it makes you wonder, all these people from the extreme radical nationalists, not the civic nationalists, but the actual white nationalists, they are out there. They're out there, but they're not as in the big numbers that the media is trying to suggest. And then also the radical Antifa and Black Lives Matter people who are all like, kill the honkies, you know, and the Antifa people who go around saying that are white themselves. Now, you have both sides with these radical reactionaries and everything, and you know, I say a lot of things that are extreme myself, but you have both these sides who are willing to get violent, who are willing to go to these things armed with both, like, everything from shanks to bear mace, guns, and they engage in live-action role-playing that they think is some sort of cultural, you know, statement. And, I mean, at least they're doing something that they believe in, but it makes you wonder, wouldn't these people, when they're willing to go that far and fight for something, would they be better served to consider a career in the military?
that's a great choice.
Both sides.
Yeah, I think the problem is all these people are weekend warriors. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is literally, we literally have a one day a week protest or rally for something, and they all roll out for it and then, you know, wait a couple weeks, then roll out for it again. So, again, I think you hit on it to begin with, saying that there's just not the level of discipline or actually sustained energy for that sort of thing.
Mm. Where do we go from here? Do we want to actually engage in an all-out, you know, skirmish with the people in fiction and comic books, or do we just want to, you know, man the fort, hold down the forts, you know, of our own beliefs, or do we actually want to finish it and get, you know, I mean, root these people out from our beloved storytelling institutions.
I think they're firmly rooted out at this point. I don't. I think even the people who are just cursorily watching, just on the political side, have probably read my article on the Federalist at this point, or at least seen the one on PJ Media last week regarding the diversity in comics scandal that just happened. So I think the awareness is already raised, and I think, you know, with the football player now, it's in sports. So now that's made it reach a whole new level. So everybody's aware that the SJW problem is so toxic in culture and so permeating in culture. And the one thing conservatives have never done in decades have really been all that supportive of conservatives in the media. So what we need to do at this point is start really pointing out projects by creators who don't hate us, or even just people who don't want to put politics into their work. I'm a big fan. I'm going to give an example right now. I'm a big fan of a guy named Matt Kint. He's a writer for comics. And, you know, I don't know anything about him. He's from New York City, and he's in the comic industry. He's probably a left-wing guy. I've read his comics, and he doesn't push anything on me. He just writes good stories. And I was listening to a podcast of him actually before I came on the show here. And he said in the interview, "I'm building a career out of writing stories and making good comics. I think trying to plug into a current event or something that's happening now is a big mistake." And, you know, I saw that and I'm like, dang, that makes me want to support you even more. Because I think he's right. I think we do need fun fiction. And I think there's room for message fiction on both sides. The problem is there's one-sided message fiction, and it's in everything now. So support authors like me. I would definitely appreciate that. Support comic creators like Chuck Dixon. Vox Day, we've mentioned before, he is coming out with a Kickstarter called Alt Hero, which is going to be, it's basically trying to send a message to the comic industry. I think we should all back that, because that's going to be a big deal in the coming days. And that success or failure is going to be a news story, believe me.
That sounds fascinating. Alt Hero, and that's by...
Alt Hero.
Did you say Vox Day or Chuck Dixon is behind that?
It's by Vox Day.
Okay.
So we need to start supporting these type of projects and start actually having reviewers and commentators not only talking about how bad the Marvel comics are, but this is a plea almost if Diversity in Comics listens to this. Don't just talk about how bad the Marvel comics are. Go out there and find comic creators who are not SJWs, who are writing their indie works, and promote those. Everybody who has a platform needs to start doing that now, and we need to support each other. And that's the only way to really change the tide of culture at this point.
Right, you are. You know Jim Starlin?
Not familiar.
The Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity Watch, Infinity War.
Oh, yeah.
Adam Warlock and such.
Of
course, most of us do. He is extremely left-wing, but oddly enough... it doesn't come across in those big, sprawling, cosmic sagas of Adam Warlock and Thanos. You know, I wish that more people could take notes from him and the other guy you mentioned, Matt Kint.
Matt Kint, he's doing Exo Manowar right now, which is basically it's basically Conan the Barbarian in Iron Man armor. It's awesome.
man, that title goes back to at least the early 90s, right?
It does, yeah.
John, I'd love to have you back soon. If you'd be interested, maybe you could contribute ongoing analysis and commentary. If you could fit this little quiet place into your busy schedule occasionally.
Sounds good. Yeah, it was fun talking to you.
All right. Check it out. Gravity of the Game by John DeLaRose next week on Amazon, I'm sure. And your personal website?
DeLaRose.com, which is DeLaRROZ.com.
Excellent. And do you have a Patreon or anything?
No, but I'm thinking about doing it because everybody else is.
Why not? Yeah, everybody else is. I'm thinking the same thing. I'm putting it off for as long as I can, but I mean, man, you know, the more I think about it, you just, you know, if it's going to become an industry standard, why not, right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you, John, and I wish you the best, and thank you for being a voice of reason in a very increasingly unreasonable world.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
All right.